All right. Well, turn with me, if you will, to the Torah portion for this evening, which begins in the book of Numbers, Bamidbar, chapter 13. And as you know, the Torah portion is named for the first unique words that appear in the portion. This one begins like this. And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, saying, send thou men. Send out some men. This is the story of the spies. In Hebrew, of course, it's shalach lecha. Send out anashim. Men. That they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I'm giving to the children of Israel. Of every tribe of their fathers, you're going to send a man, every one a prince among them. So we've got 12 tribes, going to send 12 men, 12 spies, and sometimes you'll hear the word tourists, because literally the word to go spy out is tour in the Hebrew. So these are folks who are going to go into the land and spy out the wilderness. The Torah portion actually goes through and names them. And that certainly is kind of interesting. To some extent, this may be kind of their last hurrah, because most of you know how the story is going to turn out. And hint, hint, it's not necessarily good. It goes like this. First, it tells us the names of the tribe of Reuben, Shammua, son of Zakur. And what's interesting, and I won't go through it this year, I have in years past, are the names of all of these folks are revealed. And they are also revealing. Shammua, for instance, can mean things like renowned or awestruck. Also, desolate. Kind of depends on where you put the vowel pointers. From Shimeon, Shofet, right? That kind of rings a bell, doesn't it? Judge or judged is what that one means. Of the tribe of Judah, we know this guy's name, Caleb, son of Jephunneh. And, of course, that word literally means dog. Of Issachar, we've got Egal, son of Yosef. He redeems. Of the tribe of Ephraim, fella named Hoshea, son of Nun. And this one's interesting, too, because it calls him Hoshea at this point. A little later on, we're going to find out that he has another name, a name that most people are a lot more familiar with, Yehoshua or Joshua. And of course, that's a variant of the name of the Mashiach. From Benjamin, you got Palti. Palti, okay. Ends with the I, so that means my something. And it's my deliverance or my escape. Of Zebulun, here's a name that we probably can recognize. Gadi El. El, okay. So El is the name that translates as Elohim or just El or God. And it, literally this one means El is my fortune. Then the next one, of Joseph, tribe of Manasseh, Gadi. That's almost the same name. Just my fortune, not of El. And so forth. Okay, I won't go through all the names, but basically the idea here is these folks are going to go and spy out the land, and you probably recall the basic synopsis of the story is they bring home a bad report. But really, what I think is most fascinating about this portion, as we go through it, we'll kind of emphasize this, is the underlying question for all of this. How could this possibly happen? I mean, think about it. Essentially, what this is laying out for us is these are men of renown. These are leaders of the 12 tribes. These are people who have literally walked through the parted Red Sea or Sea of Reeds. They have seen the cloud. They have seen the pillar of fire. They have seen miracles. They've seen plagues. They've seen destruction. They've seen blessing. They've seen the manna. They've seen the well, the water that flows from the rock. If there's anybody that ought to be able to say, hey, you know, you think by now we would learn to trust Yah, and if he says we can take this land, well, clearly it's true. And yet they don't. For some reason, they blow it big time. I mean, it costs them their lives, literally. So the question remains, how? And we'll probably touch on that a few times as we go through it. I think what I'm going to do is spend a lot more time on that tomorrow, and of course some of the parallels as well. And I'll just lay it out now, and then we'll touch on it again later. Some of you know that I tend to talk a lot about history and the cycles of history, and the fact that the Hebraic thought process is cyclical in nature. Sine, cosine, waves, things repeat. And the nice thing, or the interesting thing, or the thing that you notice about the way that the Creator made the universe, pendulums swing from one side to the other, they go back through the zero crossing point through the middle, but then they swing to both extremes. Sine waves go to the big positive side and then the big negative side, and they cross through zero as well, with a certain frequency. Point here is that there are extremes, and to some extent, if you want to look at the picture of the spies and ask what went on then and where are we today, I'm going to suggest just maybe one way to think about it is that we are at the opposite extreme. All right? How? How is it the spies could have been so blind to have missed the obvious? If the Creator of the universe says you can take this land, then for crying out loud, who are you to argue with it? They've seen miracles. If there's anything about this story that parallels where we are today as we go through it, I'll just suggest this up front. If we're at the opposite part of the cycle, for the most part, we haven't seen the miracles. We don't have this kind of leadership. We got leadership that literally denies the Creator, hates Him even. So to some extent, while we're making the same mistakes, it comes from the opposite perspective. Do you see the point? Hopefully. All right, that'll come back, and I think that'll play a big part. But let's go through the story, because the story also kind of helps to set the stage. Moshe sent all these folks to spy out the land of Canaan. He said to them, get up into the south and go up into the mountains. Key word here is go up. And I've heard this explained. The Midrash kind of goes through it on occasion. People have said, yeah, you know, it's interesting. They complain, the ones who bring the bad report in a few verses, they complain about how we are just little teeny grasshoppers. Had they listened to Moshe and done what he said and gone up into the mountain, I can tell you this as a pilot, everybody notices this, you get that at higher altitude, elevation, you go up on a mountain, you look down, things look really tiny. Things that might appear big if you're standing under them look really, really tiny when you're 1,000 feet higher. So had they listened to Moshe and gone up into the mountains, the perspective would have been such that these guys wouldn't have looked all that awe-inspiring. See the land, though, he says. What's in it? The people that dwell therein, whether they're strong or weak, few or many, whether the land that they dwell in is good or bad. What do the cities look like? Are they in camps? Are they in strongholds? In other words, are there walled cities there? And interestingly enough, Rashi, some of you know I enjoy looking at Rashi's insights, particularly in the Hebrew. And his comment is that this is a little bit backwards from the things that you would normally think of. In other words, if people are strong, they can live in unwalled cities out in the fields. But if they're weak, then they want to tend to be inside some nice strong walls because they're scared and fearful. So essentially what he's saying is, you know, it's not necessarily what the appearances might tend to say. A strong people don't live in walled cities. Just the opposite, again, of what you might expect, opposite of appearances. Also back about the land, whether it's fat or lean, whether there's wood there, and he says kazakh. That's the Hebrew word kazakhtem in this case, y'all. It's the all form of the conjugation of the word be strong and of good courage. Kazakh, singular, kazakh tem, you all be strong and of good courage and bring us some of the fruit of the land. The Torah tells us it was the time when the first grapes were fixing to come off the vine. So they went up and they spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin on up and to the entrance to Hamat. They went up into the south. They came into Hebron, lists a whole bunch of places where they went. Children of Anak were there. And they came into the Valley of Eshcol. Valley of Eshcol. And that literally means cluster. Great name for a place where they cut down a cluster of grapes, right? It was big enough that they had to bear it on a pole. It took two men to carry this cluster of grapes. They also got themselves some pomegranates and figs. The place was called the Valley of Eshcol because that's where they got the Eshcol. And they returned 40 days later after spying out the land. They went to Moshe and to Aaron and to Kol Edah, all of the congregation, and they brought back word, and they showed them the fruit of the land, and it starts out okay. First they said, look, we went into this land, place you sent us, and you got it, man. Hey, just as promised, it is surely flowing with milk and honey. Check out the fruit here that we brought back. You can almost hear it, right? But the folks that dwell there. They're scary dudes, man. They are fierce. The cities are fortified and very great. Wait a minute. What was it Rashi was advising? They're living in fortified cities. Maybe they're not as fearful as you might think. And we saw the children of Anak there, and worse still, Amalek dwells in the south. And there are lots of other folks. Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites, Canaanites along the sea, and Caleb. Good dog that he is, right? Loyal follower. This is a man, remember, who is literally being grafted into the tribe of Judah. Not so much born of the tribe as just by virtue of his character and his perspective. And the kind of things we're seeing in this action right here. Worthy of being called the leader of Judah. He stilled the people. He said, look, and I sometimes do this as one of the cartoon characters almost, because I can picture this guy getting excited. I like Caleb. I like this section. We need to go up now. Hey, don't wait, man. We need to possess this land. We are fully able to do what we need to do, overcome these folks. He is excited. He is rip-roaring, ready to go, and not wanting to delay at all. The men went with him, though, said, No, we can't go up against these folks. They are stronger than we. And they spread an evil report. Debat. The word also has the meaning of a whispering or a defamation. An evil report of what they had spied out in the land, saying, the land that we've possessed, passed through to spy out, it's a land that eats up its inhabitants. And we saw these folks there that are men of great, these are big dudes, they're great statures. And we saw the Nephilim, sons of Anak, who come of the Nephilim, and they were scared. We were in our own sight as grasshoppers, and so we were in their sight. And I've got that highlighted in my scriptures because I think, as it is that you appear in your own sight, so it is that you perceive others perceive you. Basically, what they're doing is they're giving a bad report. The bad report reflects on them. In other words, one of the things that I sometimes refer to is this idea of prophesying negatively. You do not let these words come out of your mouth, because as you speak, sometimes you can speak curses over yourself. And I think that's exactly what they're doing at this point. As far as we're concerned, we were grasshoppers in our own sight, and guess what? That's how we managed to come off in our appearance to them. Congregation lifted up their voice, and they cried, and the people whined themselves to sleep that night. They wept all night. By the way, that's the same phrase that we see in other places in Scripture, having to do with people like Hagar and Esau and Yaakov, who wept when he first saw Rachel. They wept. Sometimes you can weep for multiple reasons. Furthermore, they weren't done yet. It wasn't just enough that they whined. They murmured against Moshe and against Aaron, and the whole congregation said it. Have we ever heard this before? Oh, 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 oh. Wish we died in the land of Egypt. Or we could have died in the wilderness. Almost sounds like something out of a Woody Allen flick, doesn't it? Why, oh, why did Yahuwah bring us into this land so we could get whacked by the sword? Our wives and our little ones, do you catch the negative prophesying here? They will be a prey. Wouldn't it be better if we were to return to Mitzrayim, to Egypt? So they say, let's get ourselves captain. Let's do that. Let's truck on out of here. Moshe and Aaron fell on their faces before the assembly. Joshua, son of Nun, Caleb, son of Jephunneh, who were of them that spied out the land, rent their clothes. They are upset about this. They spoke to the congregation of the children of Israel, all of them, it says, and they said, look, folks, this land that we spied through to spy it out, it's a really good and exceedingly good land. If Yahuwah delights in us, he'll bring us into it. It's a land that flows with milk and honey. Just don't walk in rebellion against Yahuwah, nor fear the people of this land. They're literally bread for us. We're going to eat them alive. They have no defense against Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And if he is with us, and he will be, he says so, do not fear them. But the congregation literally decided they were going to try and stone them with stones. So, the glory of Yahuwah appears in the tent of meeting before all of the children of Israel, and he asks Moses pointedly, how long are this people going to despise me? How long will they not believe in me for all the signs that I have wrought among them? And this is, I think, the real key. Again, I come back to this idea of whether history repeats itself or rhymes or goes in the opposite direction. But what we see here, literally, are people that have, I'm going to say it, we see this line being used by Yahushua a number of places. They are without excuse. And they are. They have no stinking excuse for this, at least if you think about it logically. They have seen miracles. They know darn well that this Creator that they are following, who led them out of bondage, who led them through plagues and miracles and battles where they prevailed, can do so again. You'd think if any people who ever lived would have been able to see what is happening and what the truth is, they would be there. So, no excuse. On the one hand. On the other hand, I guess this is the interesting part. It takes me back to a couple minutes of speculation on this question. How could this happen? For crying out loud. And I saw, as you might expect, over the centuries, a lot of folks have scratched their heads over this one and said, come on. To some extent, and I talked about this last week, it's human nature to whine. It's human nature to fall short and to say, oh, this looks like it's going to be hard. I don't think I want to go. But there are some other explanations, too. Saw a nice piece from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs. He points to a Rabbi Schneerson, some of you heard that name, who points out, you know, there's another way of looking at this, too. And I think it helps in terms of the perspective that I was trying to lay out a few minutes ago about this pendulum swinging both directions, the big positive swing, the big negative swing, how it is that these people had seen all these miracles, and just maybe that gives them a slightly different perspective that's a little tougher for us to relate to. So consider this. This is how he put it. These folks, they've been eating manna from heaven. How's that for amazing food? They have been drinking water from the miraculous well, the rock. They've been surrounded by the cloud of glory. They've camped around the Mishkan, the tabernacle in the wilderness. They have seen the glory of Elohim, the Shekinah, continuously. That's a pretty tough order. That's a pretty tough, act to follow. And now they're looking and saying, okay, he wants us to go into the land. Now think about this. Just maybe there's a certain fear of change that's happening here. I mean, literally, how much better can it get? Because if you think about it, what they're being told is, now you're going to have to go out and fight some battles. Well, that doesn't sound all that appealing, does it? You're going to have to keep an army, create an economy, do some farming, work for a change. Maybe you have to worry about rain in its proper season. You're going to have to go out and live in the real world, as opposed to in the desert, Bamidbar, where every need that you have is taken care of. Your sandals haven't even worn out. It's only been 2 years by the Creator. So I guess I can at least throw that out and say it does make a certain amount of sense. Fear of change, fear of loss is a real possibility. Even if things haven't been that great, and you're talking about going into a land filled with milk and honey, it's still what we've known for a while. So consider that. Well, let's see what happens here. Now, one of the things that I won't belabor this time, I do think it's instructive, and I'll probably talk about it a little over the next couple of days because we're coming up on Independence Day weekend. And certainly, it's a lot, there's a lot going on, or at least should be a lot going on when it comes to understanding the nature of freedom and government and who we serve and what has happened to the people who came out of bondage then and the people who came out of bondage now. I think the parallels are worth pointing out. And of course, this therefore is arguably the first recorded vote in all of human history. The first democratic election. And as you know, Caleb and Joshua lost it 10-2. And I will suggest one more time, I've mentioned this a lot of times, if you go through all of Scripture and try to find anything that even remotely looks like a vote and ask yourself the question, what does the scriptural outcome look like? I will tend to point out you can't find a Democratic vote that worked out anything other than as a disaster, especially when people decide they want to vote against Yodhe Vavhe. And this is the first, the quintessential primo case, and didn't work out well either. Next part of the story kind of leads us there. How long are these people going to despise me, says Yodhe Vavhe to Moshe and Aaron. I'm going to smite them with pestilence, destroy them, and I will take and make from you a nation greater and mightier than they. Well, you know the argument that Moshe gives at this point. He says, wait a minute. When the people of the world hear, when the Egyptians hear, they will say the following. You brought these folks out here, and you couldn't do it. So if you kill this people as one man, the nations who have heard of your fame will say you weren't able to do what you swore unto them, and therefore you've slain them in the wilderness. So now, says Moshe, I pray, let the power of Yahuwah be great, just as you have spoken. And at this point, he repeats the famous words, or at least paraphrases them. Yahuwah is slow to anger, plenteous in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression, and will by no means clear the guilty. He's not asking for them to be cleared. Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, third and fourth generation. So pardon, he says, pardon, I pray you, the iniquity of this people, according to the greatness of your loving kindness. And as you have forgiven this people from Egypt, even until now. All right, says Yahuwah, I have pardoned according to your word. I have pardoned according to your word. Notice, he didn't say that he has forgotten or done a complete forgiveness. Just that he has pardoned according to the word that he has been asked by Moshe. And there's still going to be consequences. But in very deed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of Yahuwah. Surely these men have seen my glory, my signs, things I did in Egypt and in the wilderness. And yet, 10 times now they have put me to the test. They have not hearkened. They have not shamarred to my voice. And they are not going to see the land which I swore to their fathers. Nor shall any of them that despised me, any of them that registered and voted along with these folks, none of them going to see it. With two notable and obvious exceptions. My servant Caleb, because he had another spirit within him, another ruach, he followed me fully. Well, him I will bring into the land that he's already been, and his seed will possess it. So now, Amalekite and Canaanite dwell in the vale. Turn tomorrow, go into the wilderness by way of the Sea of Reeds. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and Aaron, and he said, how long am I going to bear with this evil congregation? These folks keep murmuring against me. I've heard their murmurings. They keep doing it. So say to them, as I live, says Yahuwah, surely, as you have spoken in my ears, here is what I will do to you. This is to all of the men, all of the adults that participated with that sham election that day. Your carcasses will fall in the wilderness. All that were numbered of you according to your whole number, from 20 years old and upwards, all of you, you have murmured against me. You are not going to come into the land which I lifted up my hand, saying that I would make you dwell therein, except Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and Yahushua, son of Nun. Not too many verses ago, he was referred to as Hoshea. But now he is Yahushua. He's had the Yod added to his name. And by the way, Hoshea is only referred to that way just this one time in the Torah. Your little ones, remember, you said they were going to be a prey? Well, not so much. They will be the ones that will now go into the land, and they will in fact know the land that y'all have rejected. But as for you, he repeats it, your carcasses will fall in this wilderness, and your children are going to have to wander in Bamidbar, in the wilderness for 40 years. They will bear your strings until your carcasses, every one of you, is consumed. And you spied out the land for 40 days, remember? Well, you're going to get 1 year for a day, 40 years, so that you will know my displeasure. I, Yahuwah, have spoken. I will do all of this to this evil congregation, Edah. that are gathered together against me, they will be consumed here in this wilderness, and here they shall die. So the men whom Moshe sent to spy out the land, who, and when they returned, gave the bad report, they made everybody else murmur. Now they're going to be held to an even stricter judgment. By bringing an evil report, slander, defamation against the land, those guys died by a plague. All 10 of them, bang, they're done. Joshua, son of Nun, Caleb, remained alive. Only 2 survivors, the ones that got overruled in that first recorded vote, only ones that lived from those that spied out the land. People mourned greatly when Moshe told them what was going to happen. I guess you can expect that. They rose up early in the morning. Now, after whining all night, they got up early, and they went to the top of the mountain. They said, hey, here we are. It's a little bit late, right? But let's do it anyway. We will go up to the place which Yahuwah has promised, because we have sinned. A day late, a dollar short. Why? Says Moshe, are you doing this now? It isn't going to win. You might as well save your efforts, guys. Do not go up, he says, because Yahuwah is not among you. You will, in fact, remember the line, you'll regret it. You'll regret it. You will. You'll be smitten before your enemies. Got Amalekites, Canaanites there. You'll fall by the sword. He is not with you. Well, they went anyway. You knew that. The Ark of the Covenant of Yahuwah and Moshe did not go with them. And the Amalekite and the Canaanite who dwelt there in the hill country came down, and they kick butt and took names. Chapter 15. We're going to get a change of scene and an interesting change of venue, I guess, and focus in the story at this point. It says again, Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said the following. Speak to the children of Israel. Tell them this. When you come into the land of your habitations, which I give to you, now they're realizing this is going to be quite a while, another 38 years or so. When you come into the land, you'll make an offering by fire unto Yahuwah. And whether it's a burnt offering, a korban in fulfillment of a vow uttered, or a freewill offering, or any kind of a thing, in other words, that represents a sweet savor unto Yahuwah, whether it's of the herd or the flock, then the one that presents this offering will bring to Yahuwah, and we've seen this before too, a meal offering, 10th part of an ephah of fine flour, with a 4th part of a hin of oil, wine for the drink offering, 4th part of a hin. All of this stuff is going to happen for each lamb or for a ram. Slight difference in the meal offering, it's 2/10 of an ephah in this case, and 1/3 of a hin of oil, and 1/3 of a hin of wine. When you prepare a bull for a burnt offering, for a korban, sacrifice, olah, for a vow, for peace offerings. With this one, it's now 3/10 part of an ephah of fine flour with 1/2 a hin of oil. You notice it gets a little bit bigger along with the slightly bigger mass of the animal. And now it's a 1/2 a hin of wine, too. This shall be done for each bull, for each ram, or for each of the he lambs or of the kids. According to the number that you prepare, this is how it's going to work. All of the homeborn do these things in this manner. They make an offering made by fire, a sweet savor unto Yahuwah. And furthermore, now this is something we've also heard, but it bears repeating, and I'm going to emphasize it because he does. If there is a stranger who sojourns among you, wherever, throughout your generations, and he offers an offering made by fire, as you do, he shall do. As for the congregation, there is one statute, one hook for you and for the stranger that dwells among you. It's a statute forever throughout your generations. As you are, so shall the stranger be before Yahuwah. And I pause there again and say, wow, isn't this an amazing contrast? Compare what now passes for law just about anywhere in the world. There's no longer one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. Just about anybody that's observed what's going on in the United States can say, for crying out loud, there is one law for those who get to run for president and can commit treason and are above the law. There's another law for those that don't get to do things that the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, once called God-given rights and protected, like the right to freely assemble, freedom of speech, worship, to keep and bear arms, to be free of illegal search and seizure. None of that applies unless you're one of the gifted class. And, of course, if you're a stranger in the land, you get better treatment than the homeborn. The contrast is the key here. One statute, one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. One law, verse 16 repeats it, and one ordinance shall be for both you and the stranger that sojourns among you. We're going to get one other, a couple other things here as we roll towards the finish of this one. When you get into the land, when you eat of the bread of the land, you're to set a portion of that aside as a gift to the Lord, to Yahuwah. Of the first of your dough, you set apart a cake as a gift, so you set it apart. Of the first of your dough, you give a portion, again, throughout your generations. Yet another indicator that, no, the law is not done away with. And if, it says, actually it's more like when you err, key, and you don't observe all these commandments, which Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, you mess up, you make a mistake. Well, if it is done in error by the congregation and it's hidden from their eyes, we've seen this before too in the last chapter. There is going to be an offering that is made. One young bull for a burnt offering, sweet savor unto Yahuwah, and the meal offering and the drink offering that goes with it, and one he-goat for a sin offering. This is unintentional sin. It's not known from them. It's hidden from their eyes. The priest makes atonement for the congregation of B'nai Israel, the children of Israel, and they will be forgiven. It was a mistake. It was an error. They brought the offering. And all of the congregation of the children of Israel shall be forgiven. Same thing goes for the stranger that sojourns among them, because, it says, we're talking about something that was done in error. And same thing happens if a single person sins through error. One more time, the emphasis here of the Torah is that there are offerings that are made, korban, you can call them sin offerings, but they are for unintentional sin. This applies to he that is homeborn and the stranger that sojourns among you. Again, one law, one Torah for him and for the stranger and for people who do things in error. So far, so good, right? But, keyword, but, someone does something, the nefesh, the soul that does something with a high hand, knows darn well it's wrong, in other words, homeborn or stranger, he blasphemes Yahuwah. That soul is to be cut off from among his people. Because he has despised the word of Yahuwah, he broke his commandment, that soul shall be utterly cut off, his iniquity shall be upon him. Essentially, this is another repetition. In years past, I've called this the elephant in the room. Torah literally paints a picture of the kinds of things that there are, korban offerings, peace offerings, shalanim, sin offerings, things that are lifted up, all kinds of stuff. But in general, they're either free will offerings, they're peace offerings, or they are for unintentional sin. But for those that do something with a high hand intentionally, the requirement is they be cut off. His iniquity shall be upon him. I know what you're thinking, right? What about the case that we see written of in the apostolic writings? The elephant in the room, basically, this is the one case. And if you think about it, and if you read it in this context, I guess it makes sense. The soul that does something with a high hand, he is to be cut off because he despised the word of Yahuwah, broke his commandment, his iniquity is upon him. Is there another option here that's kind of being outlined again by painting with the brush around and leaving the picture in the middle? How about him who doesn't do anything wrong, certainly not with a high hand, but instead simply bears iniquity anyway? Interesting that the next story we get is about a man who ought to know better. And it's kind of unique in the Torah in this sense. While the children of Israel were still in the wilderness, children of Israel, they found a man out gathering sticks upon the Sabbath day. He is without excuse. He should have known better. They put him in a ward. In other words, they did one of the few things. It's one of the few times where you'll see in the Torah prison. And it's very clear, this is not a prison sentence. This is just, they're putting him somewhere safe for a while till they figure out what to do with him. So they put him in ward because it hadn't been declared yet what was going to happen. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, this man is to be put to death, surely. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So they brought him outside the camp, they stoned him with stones, and he died, as Yahuwah commanded Moshe. After we see a discussion of intentional sin, what is the very first example, literally the singular example, that Scripture gives us? Interestingly, breaking of the Sabbath. It's ironic, I think, that we live in a land and we have a so-called church that has taught for 17 centuries that we don't care about that stuff. That's all old stuff, done away with, nailed to the cross. And if you're looking for an example of how it is that the Creator of the universe reacts to this, the very example that he gives, a man who willfully, with a high hand, breaks the Sabbath commandment, is the first one to be stoned. And then we get this. Now, this is one of two places where this particular set of commandments is given, having to do with something that probably a lot of us know about. It's called the tzitzit, the fringes. It's a reminder, and it follows what happens to intentional sin, what happens when it comes to breaking of the Sabbath explicitly on purpose, and, oh, let's remember all of this. How are we going to do that? Speak to the children of Israel. It says, bid them. They make, here it comes again, throughout their generations. Here's another thing that I will suggest to you. It still applies. Certainly worth doing. And I can give you my brief personal testimony. It works. You put these things on your on the fringes of your garments. And no, I don't do it in the way that some traditional Jews would do it. We've got some neighbors that think it's kind of humorous. We've had this discussion. I've got some tzitzit that literally I clip onto the belt loops of my blue jeans. And I wear them around. And I remember my Jewish Orthodox neighbor and friend looking at it saying, well, I can't say that I've ever seen that before. I said, well, you know, there's nothing that says that you can't do it that way. And it certainly is a reminder. So I find that it's valuable. I'm not saying you have to do likewise, obviously. But I do think that the reason the Torah portion ends with this particular, about four verses or so, is instructive. So, tell the children of Israel, throughout their generations, put some fringes on the tzitzit, the corners of their garment. With each fringe, you make a thread of blue in them, tekelet. So, there is literally... When it comes to the commandment here, we're talking about fringes, corners of the garments. Does that mean four? Generally, it's understood that it means four. At least in this particular portion, we don't see the number specified. Could it be a tri-cornered garment? I don't know. I think the key is the one thing that is commanded is that there be a blue thread as part of it. And it says this, here's the real essence of this. It shall be a fringe for you, a tzitzit, so that when you look on it, you will remember all of the commandments, kol mitzvot, all of the mitzvot of Yahuwah. Why? So that you can do them. You look at it, you remember, you do. It's real simple. And interestingly enough, in this verse, we see the very same word that was used to describe the spies. Talk about coming full circle as we close out the portion. So that you do not go spying after your own heart. Making a tourist of your heart. Spying after your own heart and your own eyes, which essentially you use to lead yourself astray. You got this little blue thread. Now, here's a little bit more of my own personal testimony on this, if you will. If you hang them on your belt loops, and again, I'm not saying you have to. I'm just saying that I often do. And I reach in my pocket to get my keys or to get my pocket knife out or something like that. And I'll tell you what happens. A little tzitzit catch my hand. Because the tzitzit, sometimes they go in your pocket. Sometimes they hang down. Anyway, I reach in my pocket for my pocket knife, and I come up with a tzitzit instead. And guess what? It helps me to remember the commandments of Yah. I look down. Oh yeah, that's my tzitzit. Just takes a second, but it's a wonderful little easy to do thing. And again, like so many other things, no, has not been done away with. Here is a mitzvah, a commandment that we can still do. Yeah, by the way, I don't see that there is any prohibition against females doing it too. Just says all y'all. And the gender pronoun that's used in the Hebrew is masculine, but essentially that means masculine and feminine. That's the way the language works. So I don't have a problem with women wearing tzitzit either. I do say that, you know, when it comes to the halacha for a particular house, I will leave that up to the head of the house, whoever the head of the house is, to make that ruling as to whether or not they do all of these things. Just remember that the head of the house is the one that's going to be responsible before the Creator when the time comes. So bear all of this in mind, because verse 40 says, this is so you can remember and do kol mitzvoti. Kol mitzvoti. All of my T, that's the ending there. All of my commandments, and be set apart Kadoshim to your Elohim, Elohekem. And then he signs it. The Torah portion ends, Ani Yahuwah Elohekem. I am Yahuwah, your El, who brought you out of the land of Mitzrayim to be your Elohim. And then if we didn't get it, he says it again, Ani Yahuwah Elohekem. I am. And what a great way to end the portion. It literally starts with a listing of the names of people who ought to know better. They bring a bad report. They go up against the Creator of the universe. They lose. We get a reminder of what it means and what the consequences are of unintentional sin. And as if there's any doubt, that's followed up with the consequences of intentional sin. And then finally, yet another reminder. How is it we can remember all of his commandments? Real simple. Just take these little things, put a blue thread to kill it in the corners of your garments, in these fringes, and when you see them, you'll remember so that you can do what it is that he says to do. May it be so. All right, let's talk for a little while about, I keep having to say it this way, what the heck? Sometimes I clean it up, sometimes I don't, because I contend that what is being done right before our very eyes, folks, whether we believe in the Catholic Dante's Inferno kind of hell or not, is a literal hell on earth being created. And we can see it on so many fronts. But let's start with this one, because I guess if there is a single theme this week, it's literally this idea of lawlessness abounding. One Torah, one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. Hell no! We got one law for the elite, one law for those that are above all the law, and they're going to rub everybody else's noses in it. Let's start with this one. Let me ask this question. This will give us some ones anyway. Give me some ones if you heard about the meeting between the Department of Just Us head, one of the most evil females in the United States, and that's saying a whole lot, Loretta Lynch Mob, and the husband of the arguably most evil female in the United States, Hillary Clinton, on the tarmac at Phoenix Airport, Sky Harbor Airport, earlier this week. So give me some ones if you heard about that little teeny conflict of interest story. Twos if not. Because a lot of folks did hear about it. Seems that what happened was Loretta Lynch Mob was watched by a local TV channel reporter. And, you know, essentially people are saying, you don't think this is a little bit of a conflict of interest? No, no, it's just a coincidence. Amazing coincidence. Turns out that literally, very, very shortly after that auspicious meeting, where nothing of any importance was discussed, the Benghazi report on treason, although they, of course, don't call it that, was released. The report slams Hillary for her repeated lies about the cause of the attacks, but basically, essentially, the bottom line is, even so, it was soft-pedaled. And maybe that's part of what the Lynch Mob was telling the former president there in a meeting that arguably was rubbing Americans' noses into the fact that some of you are above the law. What was funny was the next day there was such a stink, even the leftists in the major media, even the White House, almost seems to have found shame. And they said, well, you know, the optics aren't good. In other words, looks like a conflict of interest, smells like a conflict of interest. Who could possibly think it was a conflict of interest? So the story was this. I saw it in the Daily Mail, and New York Times evidently did it. Loretta Lynch Mob said, well, because of the apparent conflict of interest, she'll back off. And she won't even overrule the FBI. She'll quit stonewalling them and let them come out and indict her if they want. Well, then today I saw the story. Well, not so fast. She's changed her mind. She reserves the right to do whatever she wants to. FBI be damned. And again, bottom line, it's just another in-your-face little bit of rubbing here of how far gone the rule of law is. But we got other examples, too, all of which came out this week. For this one, the FBI, you know, the ones that have been stonewalling the investigation of what happened in Orlando. Maybe or maybe not, they had controllers on the scene. Lots and lots of eyewitnesses and others saying there were multiple shooters, not the first time, not the last time. And the same Loretta Lynch Mob told people a few days, it was last weekend as a matter of fact, that we are going to scrub any politically incorrect things we don't want the public to know. Like, you know, praises to Allah and indications that he's doing this for ISIS. No, you peons don't have a right to know that. So they scrubbed that. Then the next day, just like what they did this most recent time, they backed off and said, no, no, we're going to release the transcripts after all. We're not going to redact them like we had said we were going to do. And then when the transcripts came out, they'd lied again. They went ahead and redacted them anyway. And they scrubbed references to Allah. Well, that's not all. Came out later in the week that the FBI has told all of the Florida agencies, from hospitals to law enforcement, anybody that had issues with the attacks, 911 calls, public records, all kinds of things that they have basically said, the hell with Florida's open public records law. These are all supposed to be subject to Freedom of Information Act requests, recordings, public notes, and so forth. But the FBI says no. They issued a letter, and it essentially said, this is an ongoing investigation. It will be, you can rest assured, for most of the rest of your all's lives. And so, therefore, we're going to say clamp a lid on it. People in Florida are saying the FBI doesn't have the authority to hijack Florida's constitution and laws, which guarantees public access to public records. But FBI doesn't see it that way. But we're just getting started, because this is probably the worst. Well, that's saying a lot. This is one of the most evil of the bunch. The so-called Supreme Court, I refer to them as the nine, now there's eight. They killed one of them. The eight black robe priests of other gods basically came out this week and said, look, you want to see double-mindedness in action? You really want to see a set of rulings that shows that the law isn't worth squat, that the Supreme Court regards the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as mere toilet paper. Get this. In the very same day, two rulings came out that made that clear. First, in Texas, there were some restrictions on abortions. And essentially, what the Texas court says is that if people are going to offer, what the Texas law says, if people are going to offer abortions, well, then they have to have access to things like emergency rooms. You know, presumably in the case that somebody's getting an abortion and they have an embolism or what's the term for uncontrolled bleeding, that maybe they might be able to save their life. That's the claim that they're getting the abortion for anyway, right? The Supreme Court said no. And get this. Here is what the ACLU said about the recent ruling called Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstadt. They threw out the Texas law. And the court, said the ACLU, reaffirmed, get this, and I'm going to try to be as blunt as I can here, that the Constitution protects not just the theoretical right to an abortion. Now, wait a second. Let's pause for a second. Where the hell in the Constitution does the word abortion appear? Oh, it's the right to privacy, right? That's what they're... Well, wait a second. You don't have a right to be free of illegal search and seizure. Isn't that supposed to be privacy in your persons, houses, papers, and effects? Can you see how obscene this is? The court says a woman has a right to privacy unless we want to grope her breasts at an airport. And she has a right to privacy unless we want to take her stuff, look at what she's got on her laptop, tap her phones. The only right to privacy she's got is to kill something that's growing in her womb. How obscene is that? And it's not in print. There is no right to abortion in the Constitution. But the ACLU said this is not just a theoretical right to abortion, but the right of a woman to actually get one without unwarranted interference from politicians. Unquote. Barry Sabarco, the emperor, said the Texas law put women's health and placed an unconstitutional obstacle in the path of reproductive freedom. Unquote. Now, here's the funny part, okay? So consider the contradictions here. No actual, genuine print that says anything about abortion. And the so-called right to a privacy does not apply to anything like your persons, houses, papers, and effects. Or, as others have pointed out, if they have a traffic report, unpaid parking tickets, Utah versus Streif ruling not long ago said that's enough to stop, detain, arrest, and search you. So your right to privacy? No, it doesn't exist. They can rape it with a stick if they want. The only right to privacy you have, if you're a woman, is an abortion. But you can't stop somebody from raping you with a gun. And here comes the other court ruling very same day. The court ruled against two plaintiffs in a suit called Voisin versus United States. And basically what the court says is, we can infringe the living hell out of your right to keep and bear arms if you have ever, ever, ever been convicted of so much as a misdemeanor. You got no stinking privilege anymore. We will infringe all we want. Now, ironically, Justice Clarence Thomas broke his decade-long silence to ask a couple of pointed questions when this one was being reviewed. He says, hey, I'm just curious, what other constitutional rights can be suspended on a whim due to a misdemeanor conviction? So at least he seems to get it. I hope the contradiction is obvious here. There is a, what's it called? It's called a law. No, it's actually called the supreme law of the land. It's a right that is protected in genuine print by the Bill of Rights. It says, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. The court says, the hell with your so-called rights. We'll infringe it all we want, and we could care less what it says in print. But as far as things that aren't in print, well, that's the only right you've got left. I'll say it again. They are literally rubbing people's noses in it. One law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. There is no law other than what we make up as we go along. And we'll change it on a whim, and we will not be deterred by print or by things that it says shall not in that Constitution thing. How far gone are we? Incredible. Finally, this last one. This is almost funny by comparison to others. This all came out the same day this week. Third announcement Monday, the unanimous decision of the court to vacate the conviction of a former corrupt politician on corruption charges. Okay. There's no doubt that this case is distasteful. Basically, what the former Virginia governor did was take a bribe. It may be worse than that. But, said Justice Roberts, writing for the unanimous majority, our concern is not with tawdry tales of Ferraris and Rolexes and ball gowns. No. Get what you can, right? He wrote, it is instead with the broader legal implications of the government's boundless interpretation of the federal bribery statute. In other words, the court said, when it comes to officials who are above the law, we're going to raise the bar for corruption. If there's corruption involved, what the heck? Well, we're willing to overlook a little bribery, a Ferrari or two, a little Rolex on occasion. You know, it's you peons that think you have God-given rights to, you know, defend yourself from rape. Now we're going to throw the book at you. Next thing you know, right, if they keep raising the bar, why, pretty soon treason won't even be a problem, and people will be able to run for president after they've committed acts that any lesser mortal would have been in jail for, or maybe on death row for. How about this? Barry Sabarco. This is actually just came out this week. It was in the news because the change was announced, and Waleed Shobhat, some of you know who he is, wrote about the fact that it's been a year and Congress has not seen fit to even so much as address Barry Sabarco, a.k.a. Barack Hussein Obama, a.k.a. Barry Sotero. The man's got a million names, aliases, and probably Social Security numbers. We know at least one that's, from a place he's never been. He essentially said the following. When it comes to a Muslim or anybody else who wants to become a U.S. citizen, well, don't worry about that oath of allegiance thing. Once upon a time, people who wanted to become citizens had to promise in the oath of allegiance that they would be willing to bear arms on behalf of the United States. But the jihadist in chief has said, well, no, you, how can we expect you to bear arms on behalf of the United States when the point of bringing you in is to bear arms against the people of the United States? Remember, we're going to look the other way when it comes to your violations, right, Omar Mateen? Folks, you cannot make this stuff up, and it ought to really kind of sit in our craw. The radical change was announced July 2015. Congress has chosen fit to just not pay any attention to it. Basically, anybody that, particularly if they are an adherent of the Prophet Muhammad, can opt out of the oath of allegiance that has to do with, allegiance to these United States. They don't even have to cite any specific religious belief that forbids them to perform military service. And, it's not like the religion of peace really cares. Is there such a thing as law anymore? I will contend no. Doesn't seem to matter. On to Brexit, where, as you know, that's probably the biggest thing that's happened in the Eurozone for a while. More and more people are coming out and saying, look, this was just a vote. Politicians can ignore votes. There's discussion in the EU about a super state, basically just saying the hell with Britain's people, with their votes. We won't let them leave. We will put a military in place for the Eurozone, get rid of armies from the independent states and so forth. So as Paul Craig Roberts puts it, despite the vote, the odds are still really stacked against Britain actually being allowed to leave the EU. How it will play out remains to be seen, but there are all kinds of stories coming out, right? If somebody's got a hangnail, it's Brexit's fault. When the bad job reports came out, that's Brexit's fault. Standard & Poor's lowered their estimates for United States gross domestic product, it was blamed on Brexit. And the irony is, all of this was due to happen anyway. Same thing goes, by the way, for gold and silver in the crooked casinos. Now, this is probably one of the most interesting things. And as yours truly and lots of other folks with their hand on the pulse of the economy better than I have been saying for a long time, look, the die is cast. You cannot have this kind of a debt load. You cannot have the can kick down the road this many times with the largest amount of debt, public, private, you name it, in all of human history, with interest rates that are not only at zero, but that are going negative in many parts of the world. This situation cannot continue. And there's an old saying, that which cannot continue won't. So they're looking for an excuse. Brexit was a great excuse, but some of this, probably all of it, would have happened anyway. Any other excuse would have done it, but Brexit was a great one. Well, to my mind, the interesting news this week was in the crooked casinos, the gold and silver markets, even the markets where they can sell paper without limit to try to suppress prices. Now, it turns out that what's been going on for a long time, I've talked about it many, many weeks, is that, you can only sell paper gold and paper silver for so long before finally somebody says, I'd like to have it. I'd like to take delivery of it. And it turns out that, like Mother Hubbard, the cupboard is bare. Can't be delivered. There isn't enough to deliver. And it looks like, whether Brexit was the cause or not, this is the week when, a lot of stuff seems to have hit the fan. So, when the week closed, gold today was up another 1.5%, $20. It's now trading not at $1,250 or $1,280 or $1,300, but it about $1,342 to a paper ounce. But that's only the beginning of the story. Silver ripped through $17 an ounce, and then through $18 an ounce, and then through $19 an ounce. It was up. Biggest day I can remember seeing in a long time today, silver was up a full $1.06, even in the crooked, you don't have to worry about taking delivery casinos. That's a 5.7% move in a single day. And in a week, silver is up over 10%. I mean, this is incredible. And essentially, it's doing a lot of things to the charts. And it's the kind of thing that the decent analysts have been saying to expect for a long time, right? KSEF, real money. You can't keep lying forever. We'll close it up with one or two other stories. How about this one? Alan Greenspan. I said this last week, he came out on Monday and said it again. Last week it was, this is the worst period I recall. There's nothing like it. So he's admitting it. And then he came out this last Monday and in a major interview, he said he was a gold bug all along. And he believes, and this is what he wrote in 1966, that there's only one way that the crooked Federal Reserve, of which he was the maestro for a long time, can be prevented from pushing hyperinflation on a generally dumbed down public. Answer, precious metals, the gold standard, or at least the ability to redeem things in gold. So Greenspan has come out and said again what it is that he kind of didn't say for a long, long time, but now that it's too late, he's admitting it again. And then finally we got this. While you were distracted by Brexit, said Natural News, did you know that Monsanto's puppets in the U.S. Senate announced a new compromise to outlaw GMO labeling? Yeah, they're still on that horse. They don't want people to know what the crap that they're being fed as food really contains. Genetically modified frankenfoods. So this new compromise decrees that foods will not be labeled as genetically modified for 2 full years, while the USDA ponders the best way, as Natural News put it, to deceive consumers and hide what's in the food furthermore. Okay. The law also says that the USDA could decree that any foods that contain less than 50-50 franken content could still be called non-GMO. In other words, they could feed you half crap and tell you it's okay. What's worse, they've proposed that instead of putting labels on food so that people can actually read it and know what they're buying at the store, they put those QR code images on them that are unreadable by humans, and then they can lie about what's in it anyway. The purpose is, of course, to make it impossible for people to know what they're eating and still tell them, oh, we're not lying to you. Folks, there's, as I often remind people, we are told the men of Issachar knew the times and the seasons, so they knew what Israel should do. And we need to know what we need to do in these times. I contend the answer is come out of her. Do not participate in this stuff. Because what we see going on is just obscene. It is obscene on every front. Literally, it occurred to me today that as I was putting together some of the news summaries for the week, remember there was a paper called The Onion? It used to do these really obscene stories. The stuff that we're looking at today makes what The Onion was talking about not long ago seem pretty tame. Who would have thought that the so-called Attorney General for the United States would be openly engaging in suborning of perjury and conflicts of interest and lying about things that constitute treason? I guess she's really looking for a nicer appointment in the next regime than she's already got. You cannot make this stuff up, and you cannot excuse it. And you certainly cannot claim that there is one law for you and the stranger that dwells among you. So, with that, I encourage us. Let's lift one another up in prayer. Let us remember what the real law is, that it hasn't been done away with it, and who we serve. Because it's never, ever, ever been more important. And if we thought what happened to the spies were bad, stay tuned.